Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy New Year, everyone, and happy Sunday. And welcome to a very special edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. I'm very excited about today's show, but before I talk about our guest, I want to talk about friends and how important it is for the dear friends that are in my life. I want to start with my friend Kathleen Hochberg. She sent me last year this book, When Action Follows Heart, and it's 365 Ways to Share Kindness. And when I booked today's guest, I immediately thought of this book and what it meant to me when Kathleen gave me the book. And like today's act of kindness is to go to a local laundromat and leave some quarters behind for the next person that comes by. Just leave it on top of the lawn, on the washing machine. And then I'm thinking of my dear friend, Mindy Fratkin, AKA Princess Wow. And she has started something called the Smile Revolution. And she sent me this mug. So I'm drinking my favorite coffee out of this because she's always about making people smile. And speaking of making people smile, I'd like to give a big shout out to my dear, dear friend, Deborah Stone, because Deborah Stone suggested to me that I celebrate our guest today, Dave McGee, AKA Dr. Moo Moo. And you will find out as the show progresses how he came to be known as Dr. Moo Moo. But my show is all about celebrating artists and their body of worth. What is it that they bring to the world and makes the world a better place? And that is the, what's the word I want to look for? I want to say epitome, but there's a word that has to be bigger and brighter and better than the word epitome that describes Dave McGee, Dr. Moo Moo. As I've gotten to know him by reading and researching, I am incredibly moved by his story. And I felt that today would be the perfect way to kickstart this year with a man who actually walks the walk and talks the talk when it comes to random acts of kindness. I'm going to share with you a video that will give you a little background on Dr. Moo Moo, and then you'll be meeting Dave McGee on the other side.
I'm not trying to save the world. I'm not trying to take people off the streets. I'm just trying to give people a moment that they know that somebody loves them. And that's the reason I go out once a week and hand out a $100 bill to somebody.
A snack, anybody? Want a snack?
I'm Dr. Moo Moo. I dress up in a costume. I'm handing out Little Debbies to get people to smile. And then as I'm doing that, I'm watching for the person who may need some help. And I hand out a $100 bill to somebody.
It's real. It's real. It's for the two of you.
Can you use it? Yes.
You're welcome.
Yes.
Thank you. It's okay. It's okay.
Oh, God bless you. Oh, girl. We're going to have a Merry Christmas.
Can you use that little boost?
Yeah.
Okay. You're welcome.
I know what it's like to not have anything. As a child, we were very, very poor.
Happy Monday to you. Have a snack.
Oh, well, God bless you. Well, thank you.
Daddy could afford 69 cents for a box of 12 Little Debbies. And so my sister and I, that was our treat. Little Debbie would always make me smile. Little Debbie sent this to me. The real Little Debbie. See, look. She signed it. Debbie McKee. As a child, it made me smile, so I think I can make other people smile with a Little Debbie. Dear God, you know who needs a boost today. Direct me and guide me to them. Amen. It's special in that somebody that's just coming up off the street that does not know you and giving you a $100 bill is a special moment. After I got married, I had like a voice tell me, you need to make a little costume, dress up, and go out and help people. When I say a voice, it's not a literal David, go put on a costume. It's your voice in my heart. I had all these black and white cows everywhere, and so people just started saying, oh, you're Dr. Moo Moo, you're the cowrapractor, all these little puns, and it stuck. I did not charge my patients. I had a cookie jar that whatever they could afford, they dropped it in there. I would take out what I needed to pay the bills that day, and the rest of it I gave away. From 1983 to now, so it's like 36 years I've been doing this. I always kept dressing up as Dr. Moo Moo a secret from everybody because that was something just personal to me that I was going to take it to my grave. The only person who knew was my ex-wife.
Oh, there's a homeless story. Did you read it?
Within a year, I met Mark after getting divorced, and we've been together now. It's 26 years this month. It's a very loving, caring relationship.
Dave was taking on his character of Dr. Moo Moo almost our entire time together, and I really just became aware of it about a year ago.
It's kind of like they outed me. I come out of the closet being gay, and I come out of the closet being Dr. Moo Moo. I was in two closets my lifetime.
It wasn't really shocking. It was all consistent with his compassion for other people.
Amigo.
He said, I'll see you again.
And I knew I would.
And now, like, it's like a special connection.
Don't you be crying on me, sister. Don't you be crying.
I know it was just for a moment we met, but it was valuable what you did for me. It helped me a lot. When Dr. Moo Moo gave me the $100, I was homeless. That money you gave me helped me get a new phone. And that helped me get the job that I have now.
I love it.
He said he prayed that day that he could bless someone. He's really like my angel that answered my prayers that day.
You do not know how many times you're an angel to other people yourself.
When I came home and told my daughter about Dr. Moo Moo, she's just so excited. She made him a gift. Boston made for you.
Oh my God, look at the green and the orange. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, look at this. I love it.
I love you.
I can take that costume anywhere, and I will keep going. If it's in my control, and I still got all my brains, I'm still going to keep going with Dr. Moo Moo and keep helping people.
Dr. Moo Moo, I finally meet you. I want to
tell
you. And I say this with all due respect to Mark and to my husband as well, but I'm in love with you. Anyone who knows me, and I've got my little Debbies here, Nutty Ooh, Buddy.
My favorite, Nutty Bar.
You can refer to me as your Nutty Buddy. I always end my shows by telling people to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. I've been saying that at the end of my shows for years, and I actually do it. I walk the walk, I talk the talk, and you do the same thing. And when our dear friend Deborah Stone suggested that I do this, I was thrilled that she made this connection.
She's an angel. I love her.
She's an angel.
So talented.
Yes. Now, before we delve into the story that brought you to this point, I want to ask you, how are you and Mark doing really? I mean, in the midst of this crazy world we find ourselves in.
Okay. Well, so the last month, we've been in Palm Springs for 2 days. We were in Palm Springs from last March till, maybe like October. Mm-hmm. And then his parents, the dad is 88, the mom's 87, started spiraling downhill with their health. So we went home to take care of them. Well, the dad passed away a month ago.
I'm sorry.
And then the mother is she needs 24/7 care. So we've been staying with her and taking care of her. And we're kind of in the process of trying to get her to Palms. We're in Palm Springs now, like I said, and we're in the process of maybe trying to get her to be here with us mm-hmm. in the future. So that's been kind of hard, on top of the pandemic. But prior to them getting, start their downward spiral, we did a lot of hiking and biking here in Palm Springs. to be able to go through the pandemic. When I get my butt on that bike seat, that's my zen. And that's when I have my creative moments and I get lost.
But you're also an artist as well.
I do some drawings.
Yes. Are you creating art during this time frame?
I am creating art, and I don't know if you know this or not, but I do the accordion, and so I tap dance lessons, but that's all kind of on hold because of the COVID.
Right.
Yeah. So that's my artistic tap dancing and accordion.
Now, you know, and there is another unique connection that you and I had here that I'm going to share. Anyone who's watching, this will be also on podcast later, but anyone who's actually watching the video can see Margaret Hamilton looking over your shoulders. And I've got something that she wants.
Oh, I love it. And you did not know this was going to be above it.
Like, no.
You didn't know this was going to be above me. That's so funny that you had those handy.
Anyone who knows me, when I was a kid, The Wizard of Oz was my movie. I shared with you earlier that I got to know Margaret Hamilton, which was, you know, just very unique. So to see her there, I know she's looking over us. And the wonderful thing, and I'm going to say this about her, she played the Wicked Witch of the West, but she was the nicest, sweetest person on the planet. And your story, should I call you Dr. Moo Moo or should I call you Dave?
You can call me Moo. A lot of people just call me Moo.
Okay, Moo. I want to ask you, you've had a lot of bumps in the road, but you have overcome those bumps. So I want to talk about a few of those bumps and how you got through it. Because right now, all of us are dealing with a major bump in the road.
We got some bumps, sure.
And as my dear friend, you know, David Friedman always says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And so the things that have affected you in your life, that have created Moo, are, you know, another person may have reacted a completely different way. So I want to begin, first of all, by going back to the five-year-old Dave, before you became Moo. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about who that little boy was, where you were growing up, your parents, brothers and sisters. Just give us a sense of who you were at that point.
Okay. From as far back as I can remember, my parents moved from South Dakota to Oklahoma. Because my dad was going to go to college there. And then he was going to a technical school in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, to become an electronics technician. And I wasn't born yet. But after we were there, I came along. And Mom, she was, her mother was in an insane asylum all of her life with paranoid schizophrenia. And all of her mom's aunts, everybody was mentally ill. Well,
Dave, but at that time they didn't have the label of schizophrenia with it, or did they?
It was like nervous breakdowns, mm-hmm. and different, that's the terms that they'd always tell us that Mom had another nervous breakdown. So it was always nervous breakdowns. But as you know, with me becoming a doctor and my education, I figured out what her diagnosis was after the fact. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Mom was completely normal until I was born. At least that's what she told me. That a lot of times paranoid schizophrenia, it doesn't come, the onset's not until like early adulthood or late teens. And a lot of times it's trauma or like when a person figures out that they're going to have to be on their own or that they're going to have to be a responsible person now, then that can trigger the paranoid schizophrenia.
And now, did you have brothers and sisters?
One sister after me.
Okay. So you were the firstborn. I mean, would this by diagnosis now be considered postpartum depression that your mom had?
It could have probably, I'm sure that's what triggered it, mm-hmm. right? And so, because she had told me when I was little I was the cause of her illness, and she knew I didn't mean to, but I pretty much ruined her life.
And how old were you when she first told you this?
I was about 4 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, all my life I knew that she had kind of instilled that in me that I was the reason she was like she was. And my dad, I knew that he thought the same thing, because every year on my birthday, he would go out and get drunk and he would not acknowledge my birthday. He would always tell my mom that we couldn't afford to get me a present. But, you know, when my little sister came along, it was a completely different story. They always celebrated her birthday and he was there. But Daddy, I know he loved me because every other day of the year, he was right there. But just that day.
One particular day. Did your dad drink at other times?
Well, he was a drinker, but only on the weekends. He was a weekend drinker. He was a good dad, and he was a good provider. Your dad was that way, too?
Yes, absolutely.
So, I think back in the 60s and that era, there was a lot of weekend drinkers.
My father, and maybe this was the situation with you, my father was not a social drinker. My father would basically stock up for the weekend on Friday night. And by 7 o'clock on Friday night, my father would either be passed out or would be in a violent rage. And I lived with that for the first 18 years of my life. Wow. So I can empathize with you with what you were going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what Daddy was. And you know what? And I, as an adult, and I look back, I go, you know what? Daddy stuck with us with a mentally ill wife. And, you know, he had to have an outlet to, and the drinking was his, that's the way he kind of, you know, he had something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, he just had a wife who was in and out. She was in and out of the state mental hospital all of her life until she finally checked out.
So when your mom was in the mental hospital and your father was raising two children, was he present or did you have outside help come in to help?
I kind of became the mom. So I kind of...
Even at an early age?
Yeah. We had a next door neighbor who she kind of, you know, she would help oversee as she could. But I can remember, like, at 7 years old, getting a piece of paper and making a little diagram, a graph. At the top, I'd say, Mama's medicine. And I'd put the days of the week along, and then, like, lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the top. And I would make my mom check off that she took her medicine each day at the point of times, because if she took her medicine, she'd be a mom and she'd stay home with us. And so, you know, at 7 years old, and I look back, I go, man, I was kind of responsible,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that of making sure she took her medicine. And because I knew I loved my mom so much and I wanted her to stay with us.
Of course.
And I knew if she took her medicine, she would.
But some children feel, especially when you're dealing with a parent that's dealing with like alcoholism, as a result of my dad's drinking, I don't drink at all. Did you ever have the fears or concerns that you would go down the same path that your mom did?
No, because it was so prevalent. I mean, in her brother. Mama had a sister and a brother, and the one brother, I mean, he's very successful. He had like a yacht and an airplane but he fought depression severely until, he was sailing around the world in his boat and was, stopped there to have drinks with the locals and, was talking to at the bar with, the person who had the parasailing company. And he said, would you take me up tomorrow? He said, I'll pay you X amount of dollars to take me up. And I want to let go of that whatever you hang on to while you're parasailing. And then I want to dive. I just wanted, he was a skydiver. He loved doing tempting death things. And so he said, I want to do that. And so the guy said, okay, we'll do it. So he did it. And my uncle knew exactly how to land so that he would break his neck. And so this was his way of committing suicide. And everybody thought it was an accident, but then they later found the note in the boat.
And your grandmother also committed suicide.
My grandmother, her sisters.
Her sisters.
Grandma, she died in the mental institution, at the state hospital. But her sisters, they walked into the town's lake and didn't walk out. It was a really bizarre way to die.
I mean, it's very interesting because suicide is one of those things that I've had a friend that committed suicide and everything. And there are different stages that go with it. There's anger, there's fear. There's also hiding it because there's a shame attached to it. How did your family process this as it was unfolding?
Well, actually, with Mama's suicide, I mean, I guess I can talk about that, right?
Yes.
Daddy was in the hospital. I was 11 years old, and Daddy had gotten a rare, debilitating, like Parkinson's or one of those things, but it was very, very rare. And they told him that he only had like a week to live and that they needed to bring down his parents and all his family to come from South Dakota to say goodbye. And so they had all come down.
How old were you when this was happening?
11. Okay. I was 11 years old. And so the night before he passed away, I had begged Mama. It was on a Friday night, and I said I wanted to go to the hospital to see Daddy because I knew I needed to say goodbye to him. And it, you know, when you and I were little, they had rules that the children weren't allowed to go into the hospitals. And she says, "David, you know you can't go to the hospital." She says, "It's the rules." And I got so mad at her that I yelled at her that I wish she was dead and that I hated her.
Mm.
And then I ran to my bedroom, started crying. Well, she was my idol. I lived for her to stay alive. And I didn't mean it, but I just lashed out because I was a child and I was upset. And so I ran to my bedroom crying. I went to sleep. And the next morning, I wake up and I see these two legs sticking in from my bedroom door through the hallway. And I'm kind of going, "What is going on?" And I look and it was Mama. And she was laying there and she was like all bent over and her arm was like broke underneath her. And she just had her eyes wide open looking at me. And, you know, as a kid, you don't think your parents are dead. So I'm thinking I don't know what I was thinking. I thought she was still. So I started shaking her and saying, "Mama, wake up, wake up." And then I ran to the kitchen to where it was back in the old days when we had phones on the wall. I ran to the phone on the wall and I called the next door neighbor to say, "Something's wrong with Mama. You need to come over here." Well, as I do that and I hang up, I go to the kitchen table and I see the empty bottle of pills. And then next to it is a bag of my favorite candy that I knew she had stopped at the hospital like a peace offering to let me know. So I immediately talking about, you know, the thing that you want to hide the suicide from people. And so I took the empty bottle and I hid it in my drawer where my underwear was because I didn't want anyone to know she had taken those pills. And back in those days, you know, here Daddy is in the hospital dying. And back in those days, I mean, they didn't do an autopsy. They just put cardiac arrest on the death certificate. So I mainly did that because my baby sister, I didn't want her to know.
How long did you hold on to that secret?
Pardon me?
How long did you hold on to that secret?
You know, until I wrote my book, which was about 2 or 3 years ago. So all my life and until my, I have a stepmother who kind of revealed to my sister that she killed herself. But I didn't tell anyone.
And so what happened with you and your sister after your parents were both gone?
Well, I kind of would watch us while Daddy would. Well, first of all, you know, Daddy's dying. Mm-hmm. So we were going to be orphans. And so my aunt, Daddy's sister, was going to take us back to South Dakota and raise us. Well, Daddy, my best friends, and I was in the fifth grade, and my best friend, his dad was a preacher. And so Daddy wanted a preacher to come to talk to him before he died, outside of, you know, the church, the hospital priest. And so I talked to my best friend, and his dad said, "I'll go talk to him." Well, he was a Pentecostal preacher, like the old school fire brimstone. And he goes to the hospital and he prays for Daddy And then he looked at that and he said, you need to check out of this hospital because God just healed you. Well, Daddy was not religious. Mm-hmm. And he kind of looks at him and goes, huh? And he thought, well, I don't feel any different. I didn't feel any electricity through me. and so a week later, Daddy is out of the hospital. And he lived like 35, 40 years after that. Disease, when he went into remission, whatever happened, he was.
So how was this affecting you as a small child in school and in terms of friends and interaction and everything? And I know based on what I've read, what your experience was in school, and I can relate to that as well. When did the bullying start for you at school?
What happened then after that? After I lost Mama, because Mama was my idol. I love Daddy, but Mama was, gay little gay boys.
Yes.
Their mama is there. Right. Well, anyway, and when I lost her, I had to direct that love or whatever I had to somebody else. And for some reason, it went to that preacher. And so I started going to his church. And they were like the old time where the women's, they have the big hairdo. And they wear makeup, and the boys, it's the like holiness, they called it. Mm-hmm. And so I started going to that church, and well, the preacher called me in one day and said, you can't dress the way you're dressing because you don't look like Jesus. And so I kind of went, well, and so they wanted me to like wear a shirt, a white shirt, buttoned up to here with long sleeves, and your hair had to be braced back and real short, and wear like wingtip shoes with slacks. Well, at that time, at that time, everybody was wearing bell bottoms and long hair and t-shirts and platform shoes and tennis shoes. And so I stuck out like a sore thumb. But I loved that preacher so much. I would do anything he told me mm-hmm. to do because he was like my new mama.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told me, he said, when you go to school, you need to fast. Which people with back in that, I don't know if they do it now, but you'd pray and fast. Mm-hmm. And fast means you don't eat.
Right.
You give up a meal for Jesus to do answer prayers. And so he said, you need to just go to this cafeteria and you need to take your Bible and you need to fast in front of all the school and read your Bible while they all eat. Well, I did it. I mean, because
that's what you wanted. Absolutely.
Whatever he said, I would do. It was definitely like a cult. And I was right there. I was in the front pew of that cult. And so one day I went into him and I said, Brother, so what his name was. And I said, the kids were all, every day they would beat up on me. Back in the day, they'd flip you on the head like that.
Flip your ear.
And every day. Nonstop, when you change classes, there'd be that new person that'd be right there behind you doing it and the whole class laughing. Well, finally, I just told the preacher, I went to him, I said, I just can't take one more day of this. I said, I was on the verge of wanting to suicide because of the hell I was going through. And I said, I can't take one more day of them bullying me. And he looked at me and he goes, the apostles were all persecuted for Christ's sake, and you are no better than they are. He says, you have to just take your punishment. And so I just kind of looked at him and I left there and I was so depressed and I thought, okay, and I did. That's the bullying.
Did that continue all through school for you?
It continued until I finally, like my almost 11th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what happened. The preacher, he would get up and he would preach against homosexuality. And
did you know what that was? Or did you have?
Oh yeah. Well, because I knew, I knew what it was.
Mm-hmm.
They called it a queer.
Yes.
Back that time. They said he would preach against the queers. And all this stuff. And he, and I knew that I was a queer, that I couldn't, you know, I knew that God would have to keep me from that.
No, I'm always interested. I mean, when a kid, a younger kid, you know, I didn't know that I was gay until I was in my 20s. And that may sound odd to some people out there.
We all have a different fingerprint.
But as a child, how did you know that you were?
I knew from the time I was little that I'd always wanted to be around boys and not girls. As far as, and I always was attracted to older. I wanted to be around older guys. Well, because I was molested by one. And so I kind of had that attraction of being around. As far as playing, I always wanted to play with the girls. Mm-hmm. But as far as wanting to have attention, like hugs or things like that, I always wanted to be by boys or men. So I always knew. And well, anyway, the preacher, he preached again. And this preacher, oh my God, well, you know, from the story of my dad, had the power he had to say, you've been healed. And it was true. Well, the preacher, it was a small church. It was only like 50 people. He would say, David, come to the front of the church. And so you'd get up out of the pew in front of everybody and you'd walk up there. And he said, God told me you have been watching TV. And that was against the church rules. And I go, oh my God, how does he know that? And he would tell you things. And he would make you get on your knees and he would beat the altar next to you and say, you've got to plead the blood of Jesus and ask for forgiveness for this. And the church would get around you and pray for you. Well, he was such a powerful, powerful person. He could heal people. He predict your future. He'd say, this is going to happen to you. And it would happen. And so we, you know, and again, my book, I said, we had him like on a pedestal, just one notch lower than Jesus. And so he would always preach against homosexuality or queers and things. Well, one day, the next door neighbor, she said, would you come over? I'd go over and check on her every day after school. She was like, she was in her 80s and she was always in bed. And she said, come over here. I want to talk to you. And she said, would you hold my hand? I go, yeah. She says, I need to tell you something. I go, what? She goes, you know the preacher's a queer, don't you? And I go, well, first of all, the preacher had done a sermon one time, and I never forgot it. He said, don't ever gossip about me. He said, because if you do, you will be killed. He said, and he gave an example of this lady who I knew had talked about him. Well, her child, right after that, was killed by a drunk driver.
Oh, my God.
And so that was like reinforcement.
Planting seeds in your head. Absolutely. Right.
And so we knew, don't ever talk about him. Well, when she said he's a queer, I jerked my hand out of her hand. I said, don't say that. I said, because we're going to be killed. And so I left and I went to the preacher's
wife. How old were you at this time?
At this time, I was 14, about 14.
Okay.
So I went to the preacher's wife. And I said, the lady next door, she told me that so-and-so, your husband's a queer. I said, the preacher's a queer. Well, here's the thing. This is how stupid, you know, if you really idolize somebody, you'll be blind to their faults or whatever you think could be going on. Well, okay, like I said, this is my best friend's dad. And so I would stay all night over there and be there. Well, the pastor, the preacher, the assistant pastor and him shared a bedroom. it was like his adopted son. The preacher was probably, I'd say, maybe about pushing 50. And the assistant pastor was like in his late 20s or 30s. And they shared this bedroom. Well, as a child, he's so powerful to me that I'm thinking, oh, they're in there praying all night. I honestly thought that. I thought, oh, God, because they were so
scared. Also, when you went to his wife and you said what your neighbor said to you, you were saying this out of innocence, not because you wanted to malign him.
Right, because I was going.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I said to the preacher, I said to the preacher's wife, I was in her bedroom. She had her own bedroom. And I said, he was a queer. And she looked down. She wouldn't look me in the eyes. And I said, is it true? And she said, I'm sorry. And I said, oh, my God. I said, how does he heal people? How does he tell the future? How does he do all these miracles? And he's committing this act of being a homosexual when he preaches against that. Not that I'm saying homosexual is wrong or that you're, but when you preach against it, to me, it was wrong. I mean, it was wrong to me, no matter what. Nowadays, I don't look at it this way. But at that time, I was going, you know, being a homosexual is going to send you to hell because he told me that. And so I said, well, how does he do these miracles? And she looked me straight in the eye. She says, David, all I can tell you is that the devil's power is just right at the same level as God's. And so I was devastated. I go, oh, my God. And I got mad at her. She didn't know it. But I go, you have let me sit in a church under the power of the devil all these years. And so I was so confused. I go, because here is my idol. And then I find out that he's, you know, it's all a facade. Mm-hmm. That is not. And so then you're going to crack up on this one. I go, I'm going to be wild. So I went out, I smoked a cigarette.
That'll show them.
So I go, yeah, I'm going to show him. I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. Well, I smoked one cigarette. That was my wild day. So anyway, after that, I just quit that church and I left. And then as I became an adult and stuff, I would keep track of them and I'd, you know, check on them and stuff. And she died in the middle of the night and from a massive heart attack, and he died of AIDS.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Sad for both of them. Absolutely. And, you know, did you continue in church beyond that?
At the point whenever I found out he was a queer, I was living with him because I'd had my dad and my stepmother had pretty much thrown us out of their property when I was 14, 15 years old. And so we didn't have anywhere to live, and he took me in. And when that's happened, in the meantime, another minister and his wife had come to our church, and they knew that I was not living with my family, that I was staying at this minister's. And they said, we would love for you to come live with us. They were an older couple and their kids were grown. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I was in this cult and I was scared to leave it. So this was, you know, before I found out the preacher's situation of being gay. And so I wouldn't leave the preacher. And once the minister's wife told me that he was gay, I was on the phone the next day and I said, do you guys still want me? And to this other minister, and they said, oh yes, we'd love to. And within a few days, I was living with him. And they immediately, this was my in between my junior and senior year, she took me out and she got me some bell bottom pants, jeans. And she got me a wardrobe of what the other kids were wearing back then. And my hair grew out. And I honestly, this is so weird, and people really can't believe it, but I went from being like the biggest nerd, and I changed schools. I went from being like the biggest nerd at the old school to like the class president and the most popular in the new school. And so, but then I never, you know, I went from one church to the next church, and I always kept my, the seeds that were planted about God in my heart. And they've always been there.
So, I mean, you're still a very spiritual person. Do you practice any type of religion now?
Am I in a religion? You know, Mark, he likes the Episcopal Church. And so I became a member with him so that he would go. Mm-hmm. But then he'd rather do yoga and I'd rather be on my bike. But every day, I mean, I always look up to God and I have like a little list of things to thank him for every day. And I mean, he's at the top. I mean, you know, I don't go to a building, to a church, but I feel like there's a church in my heart that I attend every day.
Well, I want to ask you, I mean, at this point in your life, I mean, going into a new environment, going to a new school, creating who you want to be instead of what's imposed upon you, which is essentially what was happening. You know, obviously the decisions are what's going to happen when I graduate from high school. And there were so many paths that you could have chosen to take, but you became a chiropractor. Yes. Why that route, as opposed to becoming an accordion player or a writer or a tap dancer? Why that route?
Well, actually, you know, if I had stayed in the situation, I probably never would have been gone to college. I would have just been a blue-collar worker at a factory or whatever, mm-hmm. which is nothing wrong with that.
No.
But the minister that I went to live with that finished raising me, they encouraged me to, they got me like on a social security that it could help pay for my school and give me some money because of my mother passing, being gone and my dad out of the picture. Mm-hmm. So I decided, they said, do you want to go to college? I said, yes. And I said,
did they know that you were gay at this point? Were they?
Nobody, my adopted dad never knew. Because I had gotten married, I was groomed to be married. And so he passed away right after I got divorced. So I got divorced and he passed away at 67 when I was like 30. Mm-hmm. And then my mother on her deathbed, she knew because she saw I had a wedding ring on and she knew that I had a roommate, Mark. And then she never did confront me about it. But when I left, she asked her daughter, which was my adopted sister, she said, do you think they're married? So I knew she knew that there was a bond between Mark and I.
So I want to cover the aspects of Dr. Mumu before we run out of time. Right. Your story, now you do have a book that covers all this.
Uh-huh. Snippets from the Life of Dr. Mumu. And I've got to say this. If there's anybody out there who's an agent, literary agent, or a publisher, I am looking.
I think better than that. I mean, this is a movie. This is a television. So you become a chiropractor, and you are a successful chiropractor. But one of the things that really blew me away with this story is the issues that surrounded your practice when it comes to insurance, which is a big issue in this country. So if you can tell us, you know, how you came to that point with the way that you were leading your practice.
Okay. Well, when I was back, you know, back in the 90s, when I started practicing, chiropractic was not as mainstream as it is now. And a lot of insurance would say, well, we're not going to cover this. You can't see your patient. But once this, you know, there's so many rules and stipulations that I was kind of going, you know, I had a lot of elderly patients. And I lived in Kansas City, Missouri, which is very urban. But my practice was like 30 miles north of there, which was rural. Mm-hmm. It was very, very, a lot of farmers and a lot of people who didn't have a lot of money. And so I thought, you know, I'm not going to tell my patient that they can't, that they have to stay in pain. I'm not going to be able to take care of them just because they don't have the money to pay me and because their insurance won't cover it. And so I finally, something just hit me and said, you know what? Don't charge them. Just get a little cookie jar, put it by the window. And when they leave, just have them drop in what they can afford. And so I said, well, I'll try it. And, you know, so there'd be days where when a patient would walk out and you just hear coins hit that bottom of that cookie jar. But my philosophy was I tried to not be anywhere near the cookie jar when they left. So I didn't know what they put in there. And I would never look in there until the end of the day just to get the money out so I could deposit it. So if the person put it in.
A huge leap of faith on your part to do that.
So, you know, the person who gave me 25 cents or the person who gave me $25 or $250, they all got the same care because I never knew what they gave me. Mm-hmm. Do you know what? Every month, all the bills were paid. I had gas money. I had the things that I needed taken care of was all paid. And I had my $100 a week to be able to help to do Dr. Mumu.
I know that Dr. Mumu came about, as we saw in the video, because of the cow pictures that were in your office. Right. But when was the first time that you actually went out and started distributing $100 bills?
Like 1980, between around 1983, 84. I got married in 1983. And then shortly after I was married, I've been married to a woman. I had this voice tell me I needed to do this. And so I'm kind of thinking, oh, that's so crazy. I'm not going to do that. Well, that voice kept saying, yo, yes, you are going to do that. And so I finally said, okay, well, I'll talk to my wife. And I talked to her and she goes, you know what? I completely, my wife, she was the best. She had me on a pedestal. I couldn't have got a better person. You know, if I'm going to be married to a woman, she's the one to be married to. She was fantastic.
Well, you know what I love about the fact was that she was supportive of what you wanted to do.
Absolutely. She said, okay, let's get to making this costume.
There are a lot of people who would go, are you crazy?
Right. You know, especially with my mom, right?
Yes.
With my history. But she said, okay, let's get to making the costume. And when we first started out as Dr. Mumu, we would do it in the car instead of me walking around town. So she would drive, and she'd have on her sunglasses on and kind of incognito too. And we just drive around until we found out who we thought needed help. And then we'd
roll. Now, was there a reason why you chose to wear a mask when you were doing this?
Okay. We usually would, we live downtown in a high-rise apartment, and most of the people who are waiting on the bus or need help, you're not going to really find that in suburbia. Because suburbia, everybody's taken care of pretty much. Mm-hmm. They all take care of themselves. But when you're in the downtown areas, that's when you've got people who are going to the shelters and that need help. Or, you know, New York is a different situation because a lot of people use mass transit. But in the Midwest, if you're using mass transit, you need an extra dollar. So usually I find all the people that I need to help at the bus stops. But when I lived downtown and I would, if I was, didn't have a mask on and I gave somebody $100 bill, and back in the 80s, $100 bill would be like $1,000 bill now, mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of money. And even now, $100 bills, it gets people's attention. But if I didn't have that mask on, then I wouldn't be able to walk out my apartment door without people saying, oh, there's that guy that gives away $100 bills, go get some money. It allowed me to live my like Clark Kent life.
Versus. I mean, now everybody's wearing masks everywhere you go. If they're
nobody, I don't stand out. Exactly. But the point that you made that because I go, nobody even really looks at me anymore. like I'm a weirdo.
I mean, if you walk up to someone and you're wearing a mask, obviously that's a very unusual thing to happen. What right. kind of response did you get the first time you did this?
You know, there would be a lot of times that when it's still today. I've had so many people be mean to me, and they think I was a clown, or, you know, because people are so petrified of clowns, and that they would literally be mean, kind of mean to me and say bad words. And it's so funny, it's mainly the white people. They would say, like, oh, you need to get a life, or you need, they've seen me with my smile sign hold up. So I think they thought maybe I was a homeless person, and this was my gimmick to try to get people to give me money. You know, like the street, like the people who held out signs at the street corners to get money.
I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. When I told a friend of mine that about you and that I was going to be doing this interview, and mm-hmm. I told her what you did, which I think is phenomenal and wonderful, yeah. She said, well, does he really think he's helping people instead of trying to get them the help that they need? You know what?
You can't, me as one person, I can't save the world, but right. I can give one person one moment of hope. For even if it's just for them to say, oh God, I can go get a hotel room tonight and take a shower.
And take a shower, yeah.
And to me, that's my duty and that's my purpose in life. It's not to save the world or to get rid of, eliminate homelessness or to feed the world. It's to, my purpose in life is to make one person happy that day. And I have these little cards, I'm gonna show it for you. These little smile cards that I had printed up. And on the back, it says, there's a picture of Dr. Moon. It says, after you've done what this card says, pass it on to someone else who needs it. And then sign Dr. Moon. And what I do is I take 10 of these a day and I put them in my pocket. And by the end of the day, I need to have an empty pocket before I go to bed that night. So, you know, your friend who said that, you know, a lot of times people who say something like that are people who don't even do anything for anybody.
I know.
I'm not saying that about your friend. But the people who are the talk the loudest and say things negative are usually people who need to look at themselves and say, am I helping someone? And, you know, you can help, but you can help one person in one moment. And that can make a big difference in that person's life. I mean, one day I was out doing Dr. Moon, I was dressed in my costume, and this voice said, you need to go over to this young couple. They were probably like 21, 22 years old, and they were staying awake on the bus. And it said, the voice said, go over there and tell that young man he's special. And I kind of went, I'm not going to do that. That guy's going to think I'm nuts. And so I'm standing out little Debbie's, and that voice came back and said, I said, get over there and tell that guy he's special.
I love it.
Well, I did. I said, okay, I'll do it. Well, I walk over there, and I hand him a treat, and I said, I'm supposed to tell you something. Something told me to tell you you are special. And he looks at me like I'm a nut, just like I knew he would. So he said, oh, okay. Well, I turn around and I'm handing out little Debbie's, and I turn around and the guy is right there in my face and he's crying. And I go, are you okay, Nico? Can you talk to me a minute? I go, yeah. And he says, you didn't know this. He said, but I just like 2 hours ago checked out of the psychiatric ward of the hospital for trying to commit suicide. And he said, what you just told me gives me hope. And so in answer to your friend, if you could just help one person and you save them from suicide, that's, to me, for me, is more than me going to a soup kitchen and working every day.
I totally am in agreement with you. I'm thinking of the movie.
And I did work every day in a soup kitchen. I mean, I would go 2 days a week, my office manager, I worked in a soup kitchen. So I did things not just for dressing up to help somebody one-on-one, but I did things to help organizations, and we give lots of money to organizations.
But
so your friend is...
I'm totally in agreement with you. I'm reminded of the film It's a Wonderful Life. You know,
I've never seen it.
I just saw it for the first time, believe it or not. I've seen bits and pieces over the years, but it was on a couple of weeks ago, and I watched it in its entirety. And I think about this with each and every one of us. You don't know how you've affected anyone on any given day.
Exactly. And if if I helped that kid and kept him from committing, so, you know, who's to say, you know, the 2 or 3 days he may go in through depression and stuff, but just to know that you did touch somebody's life, and maybe he'll think about that maybe that was my purpose, that God created me and put me on earth to save that one person's life that one time. I feel like we all are put on earth for one particular purpose for someone.
But I have to ask this question before we do run out of time. When Mark found out about it, how did he find out about it, and what was his response?
Okay. Well, I didn't want anyone. I'm one of these that you don't do things to get a pat on the back.
Right.
Man, I thought, well, you know, if I'm telling everybody that I'm doing this, then they're all going to be going, oh, yeah, you're such a good person. And that takes away from my.
I want to say this. I asked you to do this show, and every person watching is patting you on the back right now.
And it is. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody out there in TV land. But Mark, I didn't plan on anyone ever knowing, but what happened is the local newspaper, the Kansas City Star, had heard about my book. And they said, we want to read it, one of the journalists. And so he read it, and then he called me and he said, this book's not true. He said, there's no way that all this could have happened to you, and that all these stories. He said, I don't believe any of it. He said, I don't believe all of it. And so he said, I want phone numbers. And so I gave him phone numbers of all the people. And then he within a week, he came and goes, oh, my God, it is true. Because he wouldn't add leading questions. Just say, tell me about such and such. And then the person would say, reiterate exactly what was in the book. And so he said, I want to do a story on you. So he spent like a week with, us talking and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, there's a TV camera there. And I'm going, what's this? What's the camera? I said, I thought this was all incognito. You know, or undercover, that it was all going to be, because I wrote the book under Dr. Mumu. There's never a name or never me, this face, it's always the mask. And so I'm kind of going, oh my God, the Kansas City Star has has invested all this money and time this week into this story. I can't tell them no now that they're revealing me. They have to reveal. So I thought, well, maybe this is the universe's way of saying, okay, David, people need to know about it. And so I said, okay, well, I'll let them expose me. Mm-hmm. And so then that's how, in answer to your question, that's how Mark found out. I had to tell him.
I want to tell
him. The article came out.
You are truly one of the angels on this planet. I can't believe that we're at the end of the show. We'll just say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Accept it.
I'm hard for me to say thank you. It's hard for me to take.
But we're at the end of our show. Before we end the show, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. Thank you very much. If you enjoyed the show, and I hope you did, please go to my website, richardskipper.com, and sign my guest book with your thoughts about the show. If you haven't done so already, that helps to boost this show in other markets. I'm all about celebrating as many people as possible. I want to let everyone know that tomorrow afternoon, if you're around at 5 o'clock, I will be celebrating musical director Alex Rybak. Those of you in the cabaret community know he's a phenomenal talent. So I'm very excited about this. And, you know, and this is going to sound like I'm saying this because of the theme of today's show. But those of you who follow me know that I say this at the end of every show. Go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Now, what I want all of you to do today is, most of you are watching this on Facebook, I want you to go to your Facebook friends list. I want you to go to the third name on the list, and I want you to reach out and call that person. Don't text them. Don't email them. Don't private message them. Call them. And let them know what they mean in your life. Because, you know, we all have to do this.
We all make a difference.
Now,
no matter who you are, how you are, or what walk of life, everybody has that inside them to be able to make a difference.
Absolutely. And before we end the show, I want to give you the final word. Anything you want to say to expound upon anything we talked about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or any message that you want to put out to the world right now. This is the beginning of a new year, a new chapter in our lives. Anything you want to say. And Moo, from your nutty buddy, your tops. Thank you.
I love it. Thank you, Richard. The only thing I'd say is that we're all, like I said earlier, I'm just kind of reiterating what I said, but I feel like everybody has a purpose in life, and don't feel like you're not important or that you're not going to make a difference, because there was a reason you were created, and that's the reason you're put here. And let's not judge. Don't judge. You know, I know it just sounds like cliche, but judging somebody, you know, like when people look at me and see me in my mask, then they judge. They don't, you know, until they know the story or they find out. You just don't really know. And something about the mask, when I have that on, I've had people come up to me and they've opened their heart up to me and tell me things. I'm going, oh my God, why is this person telling me that? But you know why they are? Because they're not seeing a face looking back at them, judging them. Mm-hmm. It's just the mask. So it's just like this. You don't, if right now, you can't tell if I'm looking mad at you or anything. So don't have a judging attitude to other people, because they're not going to get anything out of it. And it's definitely, you don't get anything out of it. So it's all about love. All of us hug each other through virtual. But here's the hardest thing about me. I'm such a touchy, feely person that
me too.
It is this COVID has taken its toll on me, and all my friends going, David, don't you be touching? Don't you touch it? And they'll say, you promise me you won't. And so I say, okay. And then, but anyway, so let's all love each other, and let's have a 2021 phenomenal year.
Amen.
Richard, you're fantastic. Thank you so much.
You are. Thank you so much. Thank you. Goodbye, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody. I miss you.